Blog Talk Radio.
Of course, my
thing
spelled everything wrong here. Lovely.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a book, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. They never will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and on the air.
Yeah, we are live, and this is MJ Network, and this is Fran Lewis, your host. MJ, after my sister, Marcia Joyce, who I miss, and I decided to name my network after her. We're going to be in for such a treat because Warren C. Embry is here. The Ornery Gene is a unique and fantastic novel that I think everybody should read because I really think it's a fantastic novel. An ending that is tragic, climactic, and a man who died when the past comes into the present and the history of Buck's family comes into play as author Warren C. Embry creates an ending that is suspenseful, sad, and reminds us of what happens when greed, power, and wealth stand in the way of honesty and values. Characters like Travis, I love that kid, that are strong in many ways and weak in others, showing he has flaws, and Buck, who is a great role model, and Diane, who helps to bring them all together. What is the final battle? What about the past will remain dark forever? What is the mystery behind the Ornery Gene? And the author is here. Good morning, and I'm so glad that you made it to my show. Welcome. Yeah,
good morning. Good morning, Fran. Thank you.
Well, what made you decide on bullfighting and cattle breeding? Because I learned a lot reading from this book. And if I ever wanted to do bullfighting, I don't think I would. No. But what made you decide on that, but those two particular topics for this particular book?
Well, I could get in to a number of iterations of the story. The original working title of it was Death of a Bullfighter.
Okay.
And my intention was to talk about bullfighting and how individuals get into it. I had a high school friend that had been involved in the rodeo, and by the time he was 16, his knees had pretty well been blown out, and so he couldn't do roping or bulldogging or anything, but he could do bullfighting, and so that's what he did. And most people think of a bullfighter. Generally, unfortunately, they're called rodeo clowns, primarily because quite often they'll do entertaining between the rounds. But anyway, I started talking about it, and my intention was to focus on Buck's dad, but I couldn't sustain a storyline through a novel. It just wasn't enough. And so I started giving it twists. One of the twists I gave is, okay, let's make part of the storyline about the rough stock. Rough stock are your bulls, your bronx, those sorts of things. So I started doing that, and then I did another twist on it and started looking into how is rough stock selected for rodeos, and then what are some of the newer things in rodeo rough stock than what were, say, back at the start of the last century when rodeoing as a sport sort of was coming into its own. And so eventually I got to what is cattle breeding involved in coming up with your rough stock, who are the ones that are participating in this, but I couldn't let go of the bullfighter, so that stayed as a layer in the novel, but it didn't stay the primary or central. That's how bullfighting and rodeo became the focus of the novel.
I liked it. It's scary. It's such a scary sport, let me tell you. I think they were showing something on television the other day about bullfighting and people getting trampled over. You had to really be careful. And when the bulls go in the street. Oh, my God. So the first scene introduces Sam, and he's searching for something related to an anomaly related to a specific bull. This sets the stage for what would come. How does he define ornery gene? And how does this relate to genetic breeding? I mean, we do genetic breeding with people, whatever, too, but with cattle, that's interesting.
Yeah, actually, genetic breeding and the whole concept of genetic breeding and artificial insemination, all those sorts of things, actually started in the early last century with milk cows. And that's where it first started. With respect to the rodeo, it started to take shape, say, 1990s, and there was a man by the name of Bob Tallman, and he created what was called the Rough Stock Registry. And what it was here is a registry of bulls that have done well in the arena, and the intention was that, okay, the assumption is if we have a bull that does well in the arena, then surely its children or progeny will also be the same. And so he kept the book. He was keeping a book. Timeline of the start of that book was right around the time of the of this novel, which is the early 20th century. And the Rough Stock Registry was taken over by a group called the American Bucking Bull, Inc., Hobby. And they started to see the benefits of following the process closely. People were getting interested and involved in tracking this registry, just like, say, thoroughbred horse racing. And so they started holding events, which were called futurities.
Mm.
And a futurity is a program in which breeders will nominate an outstanding two-year-old bucking bull from their herds.
Wow.
Then they're compared. The futurity bulls are compared with a riderless and crash dummy bucking contest that's scored by judges. And each judge scores the different elements, including how high does the bull buck, what's the extension of its, you know, how much does it spin when it's off the ground, how much does it snap its kicks, the amount of spin that a bull exhibits. Spin is a terribly hard thing to keep a hold of when you're the rider. How much effort that the bull put into it, the degrees of difficulty that a bull shows when it's bucking, all those things. Because in the rodeo, the bulls are considered athletes just as much as the bull riders. But anyway, they take all of those elements, they combine them, and then a bull can earn up to 24 points per go-round. A go-round is, most people, the only familiarity they have with go-round is the last go-round. But the go-round is the cycle that you have 10 riders. So the first go-round is all 10 riders. Then the next go-round, the 10 riders, again, it's the second ride. And so they're scored up to 25 points per go-round.
Mm.
And then when it's done, then breeders will earn credibility in the industry based on how well their bulls do in the futurity, which then therefore increases demand for the bloodlines of those particular bulls. And there's big money in rough stock for rodeo.
It is.
They can earn.
There's a lot of competition, too. So would they fix something like that?
It's pretty hard.
You know what I'm saying? I know, and it sounds like the competition is really high. Wow.
It is, yep. And what they're looking for is the most aggressive orneriness.
Ooh, yeah, ornery bull.
Yep. Oddly enough, the orneriness comes from the mama cow. Almost said mama bull. There we go. Mama cow. most of the time. But there was a breeder, McKee, who said you can match the best bull with the best cow, but it may not produce the best bucking bull. And he said it still takes smart. And so in a sense, Sam and his dad were both right.
Mm.
Both of them. That's how genetics plays into determining the orneriness of a bull. And it's stood the test of time. There's a higher percentage.
Sam.
There's
poor
a,
Sam.
Yeah.
Yep. Poor Sam. So Buck arrives at the Sarah Watkins Ranch without knowledge. He was, so how was he killed and who found him? Poor Sam. He was nice. And tell us about my favorite character in the book, Travis. And he's the one that finds the body. And
yep.
He's, you know, he's a kid and tries very hard not to corrupt the body, and they yell at him. And I wanted to smack the sheriff in the head for yelling at him. Seriously.
Well, true story about the setting of this. I think to illustrate why the sheriff was the sheriff, from I think it was 1985 to 2015, so that's the span of 30 years,
mm-hmm.
there were no felonies in Hooker County of any kind.
Oh, wow.
It's a fairly crime-free region. The biggest thing, if you read the local newspaper, is speeding. And that's only started to be an issue. When I grew up out there, there was no state patrolman. There was none of that. You know, you drove as fast as the road would let you. But speeding and drunk driving is about the only thing that anybody ever gets ticketed for. And so when the sheriff finds out about this murder, it's not like it's out of his league. He's a smart man. He understands what police work is. He had taken the training at the State Patrol Training Center here in the state, but he had to follow what he considered to be procedures. And Travis was the one who found the body, and I think it was the British show Morse. I can't remember, but I believe one of Morse's adage was the majority of time the one who found the body did it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the sheriff was sort of operating under that assumption. Now, Travis, when he found the body, actually was fairly calm about it. And oddly enough, since he was from Lincoln, Nebraska, in the eastern part of the state, you do have murders, not every day, but on a regular basis. We have some gang activity in Lincoln and Omaha. And so Travis was more used to,
mm-hmm.
was more aware of murder and what happens to various individuals. So he was fairly calm. He knew to stay away from touching anything,
mm-hmm.
and it was tough on him because he was interested in what was going on. He wanted to know what happened. He was interested to see how Sam had been shot and so forth. But he decided to walk away, and he actually found the spur a ways away from the truck. He just figured it didn't have anything to do with the murder or anything that was going on. He picked up the spur. But other than that, he stayed away from everything. He gave Diane a call, and she said, "Well, I'll call the sheriff. You just stay there." And
mm-hmm.
he was willing. He was a little nervous about that one because he didn't know when the murder had taken place and whether he might get shot. But that's his reaction to finding the body, and that's actually why he was able to stay relatively calm.
Most people wouldn't stay relatively calm. Most people would have just like, oh my God, get me out of here, to see a dead body. Seriously.
I cannot argue with you.
That would have scared me. I've seen some strange things. Okay. So. Every time Chavez, really, I'm telling you, he's my favorite character. Every time he thinks he has a handle on what happened to Sam, and he has some good ideas, how come they don't want to listen to him? Why, because he's so young?
Well, it's Travis as a character is there because he ties Sarah and her family and all the sorts of things that are going on.
Yeah.
He's also someone from the eastern part of the state. He didn't grow up in the Sand Hills, and so things can happen to him, and he can see things, and he can talk to people about things, and it's an opportunity to explain the culture and the area, the setting. Because Diane will either tell him about it, or Sarah will, or Buck will.
Mm.
And Buck's sort of trying to help him get acclimated. Diane is too. But it truly is the case. Buck is fairly emblematic of most of the hired hands and cowboys out there. They're very laconic, or taciturn, or whatever term you want. They're very people of very, very, very few words. And so Travis, of course, is excited. He thinks he's come up with something. He starts talking. He's not shot down per se. He's not told, you know, quit talking, don't say anything. But it's also the case that what he's saying and what he's talking about is seen as a little bit skewed, because he doesn't, or he's not able of putting it into the context of the Sand Hills, like the rest of. So he's ignored a lot.
Yeah.
He's also the young person on the block too. All of that plays into why he's not.
Now we have Sarah. I like Sarah. But Sarah seems so distant, and she's so dedicated to what she's doing. Why did she create a life primarily working on her ranch, and why did she feel that was her destiny and not having a family of her own? She sort of isolated herself into one specific corner. Why did she feel that way? Because I felt like I wanted to say to her, Sarah, there's more to life than just being on a ranch, but she doesn't feel that way.
Well, yeah. Again, there are women like Sarah out in the out in the Sand Hills. Majority of them had been married, and their husband had died or been killed, or so forth. But the women out in the Sand Hills are, I guess, what women call very strong women. And people in the Sand Hills, most of the people in the Sand Hills, are not overly emotional. That doesn't mean they don't have emotions, but their reaction to stuff is, again, fairly analytical and fairly subdued. And what happens with Sarah, her brother dies, somebody has to help her dad. She's a young woman. And she's determined that she's going to keep the ranch going, and she's going to keep the ranch in the family. She doesn't at that point know what she's going to do, but that's her first thing. And as the years go by, the ranch starts taking more and more attention. Her dad dies, so now she's got to concern herself not only with keeping the ranch going, but she's got to be able to hire enough ranch hands to help her. She is focused on the work, but she's not focused on the ranch exclusively. She does have a fourth class that she has teaching about the grasses of the sandhills, and that's actually very important. Grass is the primary feed source out there, plus they also keep the sand dunes stabilized. If it weren't for the grass out in the sandhills, it would just simply be a desert like the Sahara. It literally is grass stabilized sand dunes, and you have them on the East Coast in some of the islands off the mainland, where you have basically islands that are sand, but there's enough grass in those to keep the sand stabilized so it doesn't blow all the time. So she's involved in teaching that. Mm. She's involved in understanding how things work. Of course, she goes to church every Sunday. But fundamentally, she just kept going and reached a point where she just never thought about marriage or those such things. She does take a maternal interest in Travis.
Yes, I know. And I'm going to ask more questions about that later. So we have two more characters. We have Goff, and another one that I love, but he's very distant at times, is Reams. Tell us about them, and tell us why Reams decided that he wanted to find out about the DNA and get on the case, too. I like that character.
Well, boy, which one to start with?
Whichever one you want. Doesn't matter to me.
Goff, his given name is Geoffrey, as in Geoffrey Chaucer.
Okay.
But as you know, Geoffrey Chaucer's first name starts with a G, not a J, as most people think of. And when Goff was little, he wanted to be called Jeff. He didn't want to be called Geoffrey. That sounded just wrong to him. But when one of his classmates found out that his first name started with a G, instead of calling him Jeff, he started calling him Goff. And so that name stuck. And it sort of is again, emblematic of how Goff's life takes its twists and turns, all the kinds of things that he tries to work out when he gets his attention on it, and how he wants to go. It just seems like forces outside his control or people with whom he interacts, et cetera, et cetera, that it gets twisted. So he kind of gets used to things not going his way. He gets involved in crazy ideas and crazy schemes and so forth. Reams, on the other hand, is what is affectionately called out in the western part of the state, cow cops, COWCOP, cow cops. They have what are called branding areas and branding registries, and you have brand inspectors. And a brand inspector is simply called in either at sale barns or branches and so forth to verify and certify that the brand that's on a particular set of cattle or even one individual cattle belongs to the individual that's holding it. And so their job is to inspect the brand. They have their brand book. They check the brand against the brand book, verify it, and get themselves satisfied. A brand investigator is actually a trained law enforcement officer. Investigator has gone to the state patrol, basically boot camp. It's a 14 to 16 week training in law enforcement where they learn all the investigative techniques and so forth that are there. And Reams had grown up on a ranch. He was born and raised in the area. But he had gone to college. He'd gotten his degree, and while he was there, he thought maybe he'd like to be state patrol. He thought maybe he'd be a sheriff, something like that. So he'd gotten himself a degree in criminology. And then, as I said, he'd taken his training at the state patrol. But he still loved the sand hills. He loved the area. He loved ranching. And so, again, he chose to be a cow cop. And that allowed him to continue working in the sand hills. That allowed him to help ensure that the industry that was out there, and cattle are really the only industry of the sand hills. There's been people try to do other things. You get along the river, you have some where there's water all the time. There have been people try to grow crops when it was first settled. Again, that was at the turn of the last century. There's the ranches that are there have only been around a little over 100 years. Because before that, everybody just thought that was a vast desert and nobody wanted to have anything to do with it. But the cattle is the industry. That's the cash crop. And so Reams, he wanted the opportunity to keep that properly policed. So that's why he got into it. And as an investigator, he has the right to arrest somebody. He has the power to arrest somebody. An inspector doesn't. An inspector can say, this cow does not belong to you. It's a different brand. But that's it. He can make that remark, but the investigator has to come in, and it's like in any other crime. You've got to verify all the evidence. They've got to do the questioning, and then they can make arrests, and then they can turn it over to the county attorney.
Do they ever fix it? Do they ever bribe them to give them the authorization, or to say that the DNA is good, or the cattle is good? You know, you hear about all these things, but you wonder sometimes.
They
don't fix this. Did they just actually play it straight?
I'm not aware of that, but it's certainly not. I mean, there is big money. When you get into some of this, so it would not surprise me to find that someone was willing to, to take a bribe to look the other way. But I am not
take
aware.
It in. I hope not that they don't, but you never know. I often wonder, because I know I did a show on horse racing a couple of weeks ago, and the author told me that, actually, I mean, you've been to the track. People go to the track. You can tell that the horse is being pulled back, that it's fixed, that your horse is not always going to win, but that the right horse doesn't always win. So you wonder sometimes. So,
well,
Buck, yeah, I wonder about that. I don't know why, but I do.
In terms of, and again, some of the story revolves around, there's individual ranchers, and it's a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
My mother had a cousin. They actually, it was her dad's cousin, but my mother and this person were born in the same year. But anyway, her dad, and then she inherited from her dad. They had a registered. And you have to keep books. You have to keep meticulous books. They were charged one time with altering registry records. And that does happen, because people are people.
I know. And money is money.
Money is money.
And the more you can make, sometimes it doesn't matter how. I mean, I can't tell you how many books I've read that have this as part of it. So it's just one of my curious questions. So I like Buck. He's a role model for Travis. So tell us about his past and what happens when he learns about his parents, and who relays this information to him, and how does he react? And is he going to stay on the ranch afterwards? Because I like this character.
Well, Buck, of course, is a fairly central
mm-hmm.
person in the story, and that is that's on purpose. Even in the early iterations, when I was still contemplating what I was gonna talk about and what I was gonna write about, Buck was still fairly central. His dad was fairly central, and so there was a lot of personal investigation, and the guys that I had worked with, the ranch hands that I had worked with, and so forth, all kind of sort of feed into the character of Buck. And he was born while his dad was working on a ranch in a town in northwestern, or outside of town in northwestern Nebraska, as a little kid, five and under. He was happy, seldom fussy, no problem, very attached to his mother. But after his mother dies, he kind of goes into a depression that you would expect from an only child that was attached to his mother. But it hits his dad even worse, and so his dad just starts in the downward spiral that they talk about in depression, where everything you do just makes it worse. And he then, of course, takes up drinking. And so Buck had to grow up quickly because he found that he was going to have to take care of his dad rather than the other way around. And so that actually gave Buck kind of empathy, but at the same time, the ability to make hard decisions, stick to them, live with them. His education had been a hit and miss. He was very intelligent, and learning was easy for him. But because his dad moved around, he could end up in three different schools in any given calendar year. He was never in the sports, which are big out there. If you know Nebraska, I had a brother-in-law who actually lived out in New York City, then all Newark. But he said, anytime you hear Nebraska football, anything else, maybe not. But if you've heard of Nebraska, sports are big out here. And then when it got to 10 or 11, then he started working on the ranches with his dad. He started getting paid. He could drive a tractor. He could do all the things that were necessary. And then eventually he was supporting his dad. His dad couldn't work anymore, but he would. But then he kind of gotten into the same bug with his dad. He didn't work 2-3 years on the same ranch, and then he'd go somewhere else. And then his dad died, and he was on his own. And so he starts kicking around the Sandhills region. He didn't want to leave the area. He loved ranching. Mm-hmm. He loved the Sandhills. It's just that he never wanted to get attached to people. And because he didn't want to get attached to people, because that had only ever caused him grief, his attachment to his mother, his attachment to his dad, he kept moving around, kept going from ranch to ranch, until he finally gets to Sarah's. It was a good match. Sarah needed a ranch hand that knew what he was doing, that could help her take care of the ranch, could get the things done, could teach others or oversee other ranches. And so Buck is always kind of, he's still keeping himself at a distance. And his learning about his parents, that's part of the stuff that's in the book, and what he finds out about his parents and so forth.
Okay. And well, let me, before I forget, I'm looking at my time here.
Okay.
Fry Thursday, author of Careful What You Wish For, Haley Ephron will be there. Oh, my God, was that scary book. So on the 3rd of October, I'm doing something I've never done before. I'm interviewing Dr. Robert Tostito, What the F is Wrong with Our Healthcare System, and everybody, F stands for food, seriously. He's come up with a method of showing people how to lower their cholesterol, heart rate, blood pressure, etc., with diet. This sounds interesting. On the 10th, TrinityHouseEntertainment.net, Rachel and Michael will be here. They're the ones that created this opening for my show. Will be here with their new video and song, United We Stand. On the 15th, this is so exciting, John Land and Joe Pistone will be here for Capital White. On the 16th, the author of What She Never Said. Oh, my God, is that scary? On the 21st, Gretchen with Shannon Cook. And on the 23rd, this is the first, a double interview with Silent Meridian and Pocketful of Lodestones with the author Elizabeth Crowens. That should be fun. On the 29th, one and only one of my favorite people in the universe, New York Times author Vincent Zandri, primary termination. And if you don't follow the rules, you'll find out what that means. And on the 31st, another one from Partners in Crime, another fantastic book, The Road to Nowhere with Soy Weiss. And that's just October. Wait till you figure out what's happening in November. I'm not going to tell you. It's going to be exciting. So, why does Sarah turn a blind eye to the fact that there are threats coming at her? And how come she doesn't really take them too seriously? Because that worried me too.
Well, it's not so much a blind eye as she just doesn't let things affect her. She tries not to. She sees the things that are going around. She's aware of them. But she, again, is one of those people that if it's something that she can't control or if it's outside her control, then she's not concerned with it. She's not concerned with what might happen. She's only concerned does happen. And of course she has her faith that gives her certain expectations that she can leverage against the threats and the obstacles she's had to deal with all the time that she's been out there. And so she's also quite intelligent, as you can probably see in the story, and so she's able to quickly resolve what appear to be problematic situations, problematic turns of events, and so she's able to deal with threats, and she's done it for a lot of years. if there's one thing that ranching and farming and anything teach you, it's a feast and famine business. One year you don't make any money, let alone make a profit. Other years you make a lot. So ranchers and farmers out here, they have a saying, they always want to have enough money to live 2 years without making money. And so she's
That's
used to. Yep. So
That's
I guess
amazing.
The
other character that I really like and is Diane. How come Travis seemed to gravitate to her every time something happens? Well, how does she have so much influence on him? He's really good. I like the character because she sort of centers him when he gets out of, you know, when he gets out of it. So how come she's able to, you know, why does he go to her all the time?
Well, there's a number of reasons. Diane is in the book intended to be sort of the voice of reason. She analyzes it, and she to some extent sort of states the obvious while everybody else is going down various paths. But with respect to Travis, Diane and Travis are about the same age. She has just finished her freshman year at the University of Nebraska, and he has just graduated from high school.
Mm.
Their first connection is age. He's not intimidated by her as he is intimidated by Buck and Sarah. It's also the case that she's the one that treats him in a friendly fashion. It's not that Buck and Sarah don't. It's just that that's not what Buck and Sarah do.
Mm-hmm.
That's not their personalities. They're not touchy-feely, I guess would be a phrase to use. But Diane is effervescent. She enjoys life. And they're about the same age, so that works. When things happen, Diane explains him to Travis, and there's also the connection that, as I said, she'd gone to the University of Nebraska, and that's the Lincoln campus, and he's from Lincoln. And so there's things that they can talk about together. There's things that they know. They can talk about the football team together. They can talk about the various great places to eat in Lincoln. They can talk about the campuses. They can talk about the various kinds of things that you can do in Lincoln and so forth. So all of that works towards Diane and Travis having a decent relationship out there.
Yeah, what I like about it is that they were just friends, and they didn't make it anymore. That's what I really liked about it. That's what made it better. So we have two more characters, but this is interesting. Tom and Eleanor. So tell us about the box of memories that Eleanor shares with Buck. That was interesting. How come you included that? But that sort of helped him center himself too.
Yeah, both Buck and Ellen have a box of memories. This may seem a little strange, but I actually got the idea from my mother.
Oh, good.
My mother passed away a few years ago.
Uh-huh.
And I was going to speak at her funeral.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was busy in the house. I was looking for things. I was just sort of milling around trying to come up with something to say. And I noticed an old box that held peacock turtles. I don't even know what they make. Yeah. But I had used it as a kid to hold my chess set. And so I thought, well, why in the world did Mother keep that? But when I opened it up, I looked inside, and there was just a random assortment of stuff. There's no other way to define it. It was just stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But as I started looking at the item, I realized that each of the items in there highlighted something either about myself or about one of my siblings. And there were six of it this one time. My oldest brother and youngest sister have since passed away. But there was nothing big in that box. It was all little stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So there was my oldest brother's perfect attendance Sunday school pin. That was my other brother, he's an opera performer, and so there was a playbill for the things that he had done. There was a report card of one of my sister where she had, this is my grade school, I think. This is grade school. I think she had plays. I can't remember exactly. But there were five or six or seven. And there were things in there that sort of defined my mother. She was an educator. So there were things that had education there with reference to the kids. Herself a fairly good musician. And so there were things that had to do with music. She was a member of the Grange. Her mother had and dad had been very strong members of the Grange. In fact, I think the 1938 copy of Life magazine has read about my grandmother in there. But all of those things were in there. So I thought, wow, that's neat. And so then I imagined both Buck and Eleanor having such things. Again, they weren't outwardly seeming to be attached to people in general. But even at that, there was at a level where they wanted to keep in the front of their head various things that had happened through their lives, and so they kept small mementos of times, places, events, etc. Photos, a bolo tie, a spur, 4-H ribbons, wedding invitations, all the kinds of things that at some point in their life were important. But then none of them were living. They weren't nostalgic. They were more emblematic, or I can't think of the right word right now, but symbolic is the word I was looking for. Symbolic of people and times and places. So that's the box of memories. And in many ways, Eleanor and Buck had similar things.
Well, I have to tell you, she reminds me of my mother. Because my mother died a few years ago. My mother saved every bill, every piece of paper, every driver's license that she ever had from the moment she was born. Seriously. I mean, it took like weeks just to go through one drawer. So when she died, I found my third grade report card that I really didn't need to see, even though it was all A's. My brother's report card, a whole bunch of stuff, and some stuff I didn't know about that I found out later on, you know, little secrets that you don't know about. So, yeah, but sometimes it's the little things like that, you know, can create what you can say. And I couldn't believe it sometimes. Every piece of paper. But it's just like a little report card or a picture or even, like you said, the attendance thing. That would be something my mother would keep, without a doubt. Actually, she probably would have put a frame on it and put it up on a wall. Like, I didn't want to know. So we have about 10 minutes. So there's a very important clue here. What is the significance of the spurs and in this particular book? What was the significance of the spurs? Because there were two of them.
Well,
without giving it away.
Yeah, without giving too much. In a sense, the spur is a MacGuffin,
yeah.
like Alfred Hitchcock. It's something that is all the way through the book, and it keeps tying things together. So it ties the rodeo to the sandhill, to the bull riding, to the cattle, to the buck, to Buck's dad. And it sort of keeps traveling through the story from the time that Sam looks at it and he's not really sure what it's all about. Travis then picks it up and he says, "Wow, this is neat." Then he's yelled at for having disturbed the crime scene, and that's what the spur's about. Then Buck looks at his stuff and he recognizes a spur, and so there's a second. The spur ties that, and then Tom has a spur, and Goff knows about the spur, and so forth. So the spur is, in one sense, it's a MacGuffin, and at the same time, it's used as a thread all the way through the book, so that again, bull riding and the raising of bulls and the selection of bulls and the quality of bulls and so forth, that can be talked about. So that's the significance of this book.
Well, I have to tell you, I got two copies of this book. I had the first one that I read, and then I got another one, and I made somebody very happy because I gave it to them.
Good.
But whenever I go to one of my doctors, he's really very nice, and he says, before you come, just make sure you can't get an appointment unless you bring me reading material. Seriously. So, yeah. Yesterday he told me he loved the Daniel Silva book, and he's got yours also. So what can I say? And there's another hands out for this copy, except that I write in my books, I underline, and I circle so that I remember what I have to write at the end for my book review. Then I have the book memorized, and I don't need the book. But, yeah, actually, they're not getting this one because you signed it, so it stays on my shelf. See, anybody that autographs the book, the book doesn't get given away. I get to keep it. So that's good.
Good.
So what would you say are the lessons to be learned by Travis as a result of what happened? And are you going to give him a story of his own? Because he can do a whole book alone by this point.
Yeah, I'm really not sure what I'm going to do next, unfortunately.
Oh, okay.
Travis, again, part of the book is to, you know, the education of Travis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Travis, because he starts out, you know, a greenhorn. I mean, that's what they call him out here. And, that's what he was. And through the book, he learns, and he learns about how ranching is done. He learns how to mow hay. He learns how to rake hay. He learns how to stack hay. He learns how the machinery is kept so that it can, you know, doesn't break down, because you don't want to break down miles from nowhere. He learns about the cattle industry. The branding was one of his biggest lessons, and you know, Diane sort of explained to him. He found out what it entailed in branding. And he learned that he didn't want to be at the tail end of the cap while they were branding. Messes to be had. He learned that just because there's some events that keep you going and mowing and raking, that doesn't mean that you quit working. And then he learned, I think, from Buck to not jump to conclusions too quickly.
Mm-hmm.
He learned that you get a lot more done if you put effort into the right things and doing them well. He learned from his Aunt Sarah integrity, which he saw as very important. There was just no phonyism in Aunt Sarah. What you saw is what you got. And he learned that business savvy was also important to the ranching. And he didn't really learn about passion until toward the end, but I won't get into that.
Mm-hmm.
People have to read it to see. But those are numberly lessons that Travis learned. He like you said, it's not Burger King. It's not like making burgers with Burger King. A lot of stuff is involved. And by the end,
I'm sitting and writing this. As you were talking, and I'm realizing that this particular book can be read by just about anyone. It doesn't have to be just adults. It could be YAs too, and it could be used for book groups and book discussions about, you know, responsibility and understanding, and somebody like Travis setting an example for young people. Seriously, because I'm sitting here saying, as an educator, this for high school kids, this is a great book. But people that want to get kids into reading something that's got, you know, meat in it, something that's interesting and something that's different, this book is really good. That's just my opinion.
One person asked me who should they warn away from the book, and I said, no one, anybody can read this book.
Yeah.
There's nothing.
I agree.
So, yeah, that was. I don't know that that was my intention. My personality is to not try very hard not to diss people and not to do anything untoward or write about things. It's just
Well, that's why I liked the book, and it was a surprise. But the holidays are coming, so if you want to know what to get, some of the books, I lost count, Warren, about how many books I've read since January, a couple of hundred, maybe more. I don't even know. But Hanukkah's coming, Christmas is coming, and Thanksgiving. You should bring something, you know, not just a turkey, seriously. So The Black Nowhere by Reese Hirsch, Honoré Jean. Careful What You Wish For, What She Never Said. Oh, God, that book is so good. And the new book that I just got 2 days ago, and I'm almost done with it, The Fifth Column by Andrew Gross. It is absolutely fantastic. And Sins of the Fathers by J.A. Jantz. And that's just a couple for this week that I've finished almost. So where can everybody learn more about you? And what do you think about doing? What are you thinking about doing next?
Well, there's kind of a problem, I hate to say it. I am a bit of a recluse. I never had a Facebook page. I never had any.
You should.
Yeah, well, when the publisher, when Down and Outs agreed to publish the book, they said I had to get a Facebook page, so I did. I don't own a cell phone, let alone a smartphone. I do have a Goodreads page. I do have a Facebook fan page, but I just am not very active on it. I feel bad about that. And so I'm going to try to keep stuff up. I'm not sure what I'm going to do next. I'm thinking about doing a biography of my mother.
Oh, nice.
In conjunction with my sister. Yeah, she was what made me want to do it was who won the Person of the Century in Time magazine. I said that should have been my mother. I'm thinking about writing a devotional. It's been interesting having a novel published. I've written a number of them. I haven't shared them with anybody other than this one. But there's an awful lot involved into getting a book published and marketed and read and so forth. And I'm not terribly good at that. I'm not a terribly good salesman. So I do have a web page.
Mm-hmm.
Warren Embry. How often do I get? I believe it's warrenembry.com.
Well, to be honest, I did a memoir of my mom. It's called The Daughter's Promise, and I had it published. Yeah, but the people that did my Silent Voices is out since June 9th, and I'm on a blog tour with Partners in Crime. Who else? And I've gotten some interesting book reviews and some fantastic showcases. And Cheryl gave me 5 stars, and that made my birthday a lot better than the 3 stars that I got that day. But that's okay because, you know, if everything is perfect, what can I tell you? But, yeah, my mom had Alzheimer's, and I was her caregiver. I had to retire from teaching. I worked in a public school for a very long time. I'm a reading and writing specialist and staff developer dean and a lot more than that. But she got sick, and somebody had to take care of her, and Alzheimer's is horrible. So I decided to write her story, A Daughter's Promise. The promise is I would never put her in a nursing home, and no, I did not even think about it. And it's doing very well. People that read it as a resource. So a memoir is important depending on how you write it. I wrote it from her voice, as if she was writing it and she's speaking, because I kept notes. It was like my voice and her voice. And it was published by whichever publisher, but to be honest, if I had to do it again, I probably would use Robin Surface at Fidelity, because she's really good. But I want to thank you so much. If and when you write it, make sure I get it. Because
will do.
Those are the type of things, books that I really like. And this was interesting, and if you ever think about writing a sequel, Travis is great, and Sarah, and Diane. I'm sure they have a lot. He has a lot more to say.
Yeah.
So, everyone, the sun is shining. It's beautiful outside. Have a great day, and thank you, Warren. Thank you, Cheryl, and bye.
Yep, thank you. Bye-bye.